Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
We find ourselves talking about trade all the time in the Trump era, but usually it's about something like crazy or weird that the president tweeted. But it's actually an important topic that is worth understanding. So I was really glad to get a chance to sit down with Kimberly Clausing. She's an economist at Reed and the author of a book called Open that is all about trade, globalization, and related topics. You know, if you want to know like what's going on in the trade and globalization debate, I think you're going to find this conversation really interesting. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. I'm joined today by Kimberly Clausing, a professor of economics at Reed College, the author of a new book called Open, The Progressive Case for Trade, Immigration, and Global Capital.
Yes. That's right. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So that is a lot of stuff.
Yes.
Trade, though, I think is sort of at the heart of, you know, what people worry about politically. And I think a very sort of simplistic question that I think a lot of people have is, look, the middle class has not done that well over the past generation or two. At the same time, we've seen China do really, really well. And so a natural inference is we've had these bad trade deals. Elites in the United States have sold us out. They've enriched themselves. They've enriched China. And the rest of us have been taking it on the chin. I take it that's not how you see it. But like, what's wrong with that? I mean, we see who's won, right? Chinese people have won. Rich people have won. Normal Americans have lost.
Yeah, so I agree with some of what you just said in the sense that it does appear that income inequality and wage stagnation are real problems for the middle class. And that's something that I'm very clear about in that book. But I guess where I differ from the Trump administration and many critics of international trade is this notion that trade is a zero-sum game, that somehow China's winning came at our expense. So mm-hmm. if you look at the past 35 years, it's true, China has done enormous things. And it's not just by trade. It's partly by opening up their economy to being a market economy instead of so state-run and a lot of other things like that. But at that same time that China was growing and succeeding, the United States GDP grew by enough that if you had divided that extra GDP evenly, every household could have had over $20,000 of extra income over that period.
That would be nice.
Yeah, or 70% increase in GDP per capita over the last 35 years. So that's a really enormous increase. The problem was that our growth wasn't shared. And I think the reason it wasn't shared, you can't pin it entirely on trade. There's a lot of other stuff that's happening at the same time. And as I argue in the book, if you respond to it by restricting trade, you might actually make the problem worse rather than better.
Okay, so this is interesting because, you know, you say, right, it's not zero-sum. Trump is a very zero-sum guy. And I think there's a sort of range of middle grounds that you can have there. But there's a sense that people have that there were, you know, industries that the United States had and that we have now lost. And isn't there something like actually zero-sum to that? That like we once had a furniture making industry and an mm-hmm. apparel making mm-hmm. industry, and now we sort of don't.
Oh, sure. And there's a constant adjustment cost to both trade and capitalism itself that happen every day. So take the Chinese case. It's it's true that they have expanded in sectors where we used to be strong and where we are strong no longer. So you can look very carefully at sort of the geographic variation in the Chinese import risk, basically. Mm-hmm. So some places like Mississippi actually had a lot of industries that competed directly with Chinese imports, whereas some states like Nevada had very few jobs that competed with Chinese imports. And if you use that variation, you can find, well, maybe as many as 1 million or 2 million even jobs could have been lost at the expense of these Chinese imports. So that's a very real concern and something I don't take lightly. But there's several things to keep in mind when mm-hmm. one is sort of saying, okay, well, the key to helping the middle class is then restricting trade with China. Because, first of all, there's a lot of benefits associated with that Chinese trade. It's enabled some of our other industries to be much more successful than they would be otherwise if they couldn't use, for instance, Chinese inputs in their manufacturing processes. They wouldn't be as competitive as world markets. And then, for instance, Boeing might have a smaller market share relative to Airbus. Our auto companies might be less effective and so on and so forth. So that's one issue. But a second issue that I think is even more important is that in a vibrant capitalist economy like the United States, there's just a tremendous amount of job churn on an ongoing basis. So there's mm-hmm. always people losing jobs, and there's always a lot of job creation, too. So in the typical quarter in the United States, over 6 million jobs are lost, and over 6 million jobs are created. And the net of those two numbers tends to be what's happening to the jobs numbers that you hear in those reports. But what that means is that because there's so much churn, there's always going to be a lot of dislocation and harm and people losing their jobs to robots or domestic competition or changes in tastes, right? And so if we say, okay, well, all of these problems are really because of China, then we're taking something that was like maybe responsible for 1 or 2 million jobs over a decade, right? And we're saying, okay, well, every problem is that, then we're going to be missing, one, a whole bunch of other causes, but also a much more direct ways to help workers. Because as we've seen already, and we can go into this, that protecting ourselves from Chinese trade actually can in many ways backfire and hurt U.S. workers.
So I think this churn point is an important one. You know, so my mother was a graphic designer, analog era graphic designer, and she, you know, eventually lost her job, not to imported Chinese graphic designers, but to computers and digital graphic designers. And it's very sad when something like that happens to somebody and to say, well, you know, in the aggregate, it's like better that we have computers. I mean, I think it's true, but doesn't address it, right?
Right.
But also this happens whether you have trade or not.
Right, absolutely. And if you look at the U.S. manufacturing share of unemployment, of employment, over the last 60, 70 years, it's just been on a monotonic decline, irrespective of what's been going on in other countries' trade policy. So it's definitely the case that as our economy has become richer, some types of jobs have been displaced. And that is a very real problem, and it's a problem that I think that there's a lot of really smart solutions to, like we can do wage insurance, we can expand the earned income tax credit, we can do better job supporting communities. But I think the problem with sort of lashing out at our trading partners and thinking that we can go back in time is that creates a lot of risks and sort of misunderstood dangers that could harm the very people that we're trying to ultimately help.
So what kind of danger?
Okay, so here's a few. So take our latest trade war with China.
Sure.
China has retaliated to that, which is expected, by raising tariffs on U.S. products, including, for instance, soybeans, right? Mm-hmm. So if you go and you talk to farmers in the upper Midwest, which I had the chance to do recently because I was there for my daughter's college graduation, and you talk to some of these people, they are quite upset about the fact that markets that they used to do very well in and that they felt that they were competitive and they were competing on sort of market terms with are now closed off to them and they're losing market share. And even if the Trump administration and others promised them sort of subsidies in response, you know, they would much rather just sort of compete and keep those products. So that's one area is that companies and workers that are in the export industries get hurt. But also, if you look at General Motors, for instance, General mm-hmm. Motors paid over $1 billion in tariffs on steel and other products over the past year or so. And they also closed plants in Ohio, right? And that wasn't the only reason they closed plants in Ohio. But when we put tariffs on intermediate products like steel, like other inputted simple machinery and things like that, it makes manufacturing in the U.S. more expensive, which causes a new set of shocks, right? So we talked about the shocks coming from the Chinese imports, but we're going to get new shocks coming from these tariffs, right? And so those are all really big costs. And that's even before we get to what happens at the grocery store. And
so I guess, you know, part of the moral of the story here is you either sort of have a systemic way of taking care of people who suffer economic problems or you don't, right? And if you do, then these trade problems are maybe not so bad. And if you don't, then trying to address it just with trade is not really going to generate stability in people's lives because, I don't know, it's like the balloon pushes in other directions.
Exactly. You know, and you create new types of disruption and actually you sort of destabilize people's lives because they're, you know, losing jobs that they could have had and they're having to switch sectors because we're artificially encouraging, say, U.S. steel, but we're artificially discouraging all the industries that use steel, right? So that creates its own set of disruptions.
But so in political terms, I think you often hear this sort of case for trade made around our export industries, right? When Trans-Pacific Partnership was pending, you heard a lot about this, that this was good because we were going to get access to these new Asian markets. But then a lot of Trump's logic on here is, yes, we could have tit-for-tat retaliation, but ultimately China exports more to the U.S. than we export to China, right? We're running a trade deficit. So if we go to zero, that's going to advantage the United States. So we have the upper hand in the negotiation.
Yeah. So I think one thing that's really abundantly clear is that the administration doesn't understand the basic economics of trade deficits and surpluses. So let's first start with why bilateral surpluses and deficits shouldn't be a concern. So it would be odd, in fact, if there were a bilateral trade balance, because it would imply that in every relationship, there's an equal and opposite need to trade. So for instance—
So bilateral is two countries,
it's just
right?
Just two countries, right?
The U.S. and the Bahamas.
Exactly. Or imagine yourself, right? You probably run a trade surplus with Fox Media, right? You sell your services to them and they pay you something, right? But you run a trade deficit with your local grocery store. And that's because, you know, you don't want to do all your shopping at Vox Media and you don't want to sell your labor to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. So it sort of makes sense that the bilateral things would not be balanced. Now, if you look at the overall, if you take a country's overall surplus, that's sort of like asking, does Matt each year earn enough to pay for the things he wants to buy, right? And the same is true for countries. So like if the United States is consuming more than it's producing, then it's going to run a trade deficit. And that's really why we run our trade deficits year after year, is because if you look at us as a country, our consumption exceeds our income. We're not great savers as private citizens. The government is not good at saving money. Instead, it runs a deficit. And so our country, and every year runs a deficit. And that's just sort of an arithmetic truth that the countries that are running these big overall deficits are borrowers and the countries that are running the surpluses are lenders.
Yeah,
right?
so this is like it's in all the economics textbooks and people don't know it, right?
Yeah.
But so the idea of this is that you have in each country a domestic savings equilibrium.
Right.
And that it's those domestic factors determine if you have a trade balance or not,
right?
And that the quote-unquote trade policy is not what drives this, right?
Exactly.
So we could have a 15% tariff on everything, but as long as the private sector savings rate is low, the government deficit is big, we are still going to be importing.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if you look at the trade deficit numbers since all these tariffs have come into place, it really hasn't improved. And one of the reasons it hasn't is because at the same time, we've been doing things like expanding the budget deficit by giving away all these tax cuts, you know, and doing other things that affect those big savings balances that we were talking
about.
And
this is one of the big ironies, actually, in the tax bill, right, is not only did the tax bill increase the deficit, but the specific logic of the tax bill was to try to make the United States a more attractive place for foreign investment.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I think I understand. Normal people don't see it this way, right? But these are the inverses of each other, right? If you attract foreign money, you are going to, we use the money to buy foreign goods.
Right, exactly. So, and that's exactly right. It's an equal and opposite thing. So our borrowing is the same size and sort of exact magnitude as that trade deficit. And that's just an accounting identity. That's not any sort of fancy theory. It's always true for all countries and all times. The borrowers are the ones with the deficits and the savers are the ones with the surpluses. And so, so for instance, these trade policies probably were going to divert our trade potentially like to other countries mm-hmm. that we're not targeting, but it's really unlikely to affect this overall.
Yeah. So this accounting identity, I mean, again, it's so like Trump will often say, well, we're losing $300 billion a year. Right. But you can't actually lose
right.
money in that sense. Right. It's not they're not physical, scarce physical commodities. Right.
Exactly.
So yeah. However much dollars go abroad, they like mathematically, they have to come back.
Yes. And also we could argue that we're actually the ones advantaged. We got all this stuff. And
right.
they get less stuff, right? So it's like every year they send us, you know, 100 units of stuff and we send them a smaller number of units of stuff, right? And then we could say, oh, we're the winners from this. We get a lot more of their things than they got of ours, right? And in exchange, they get these little slips of paper that say that we're going to give them more later, right?
Right.
But that's the borrowing.
But so, okay, but now the other thing that I remember from college economics yes. is that, okay, so the trade balance is driven by domestic savings, but also a low-income, fast-growing country like China should be borrowing, right? And they're not.
Yeah, so there are several puzzles, actually, in this literature. One is you might think, okay, well, capital should be more useful in poor countries, so they should be borrowing on net for the
right.
future. But one thing that we notice when we sort of look at poor countries is that they're some of each type, just like they're rich countries that they're some of each type.
Mm-hmm.
So Germany saves a lot and they run surpluses and we don't, we run deficits. And China runs a surplus typically, but Mexico runs a deficit if you look at it relative to the entire rest of the world. So I think what tends to dominate isn't so much just whether you're rich or poor, but some of the savings habits and, you know, even cultural things can affect savings, like how much people think they need to save or whether there's a safety net for old people. So, you know, if there isn't, then you might be more likely to save for those reasons. And so in a country like China, sometimes savings rates have been as high as 50%, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're saving like half of every dollar as a country. And so with such extremely high savings rates, even if investment is very high, which it is also in China, they're
mm-hmm.
investing more as a share of GDP than we are. But because their savings is even higher than their investment, they're net lenders in typical years.
But these sort of are policy choices too, right? I mean, it's even though it's not trade policy exactly, that the Chinese state acts to suppress domestic consumption, like they mm-hmm. even
yeah.
though they, even though they have pictures of Mao on their money, like they don't have a real welfare state, they don't do much old age provision, and like they could do the right. I mean, this
right.
could be the substance of a bilateral trade dialogue.
Yeah, and
even
I,
though it isn't,
and I think some of our issues with China are actually a little bit out of date. You know, because if we
uh-huh.
look at concerns about currency manipulation,
yes.
for instance, or concerns that they're suppressing consumption or concerns that they're not investing enough publicly. A lot of those are sort of outdated. They've done a lot of public investment
uh-huh.
of late. Consumption is rising a lot faster than it had been a decade ago. You know, so and in many recent instances, they've actually intervened to prop up rather than devalue their currency. You know, so it's important to not be fighting yesterday's war, too.
So these are kind of just old.
Some of them are older vestiges of the past.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
One thing you write in the book, and I think everyone sort of agrees is happening, is that people have moved out of these like trading, manufacturing sectors into what are called like non-tradable. It's like you do haircuts and stuff like that, right? I feel like there's an assumption in a lot of quarters that that is bad, that there's something worse about sort of all giving each other haircuts rather than making real things.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on how you think of services jobs. And there are sort of two types of services. Mm-hmm. Well, at least, probably more than that. But there's some services job that you think of like sort of like folding shirts at the Gap or giving someone a haircut or waiting tables that sound like low wage, not that fun mm-hmm. jobs. But there are some services jobs which, in fact, you can export and are a lot of fun. So what I do, I'm a professor of economics. Mm-hmm. You might not think of that as an export good, but I have a lot of international students. And when international students come to class, they pay tuition dollars that are effectively U.S. service exports, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a really kind of a cool industry to be exporting. You're sort of exporting higher education to the people of the world, right? It's good for those people because they get a better education, presumably, than they would have had at home, or they wouldn't have made the trip for it. But it's also good for the United States because then we have access to some of the brightest minds in the world that come here and study. You know, so those types of service professions that are in many cases expanding, and we could also include others, financial services, entertainment, high-tech types of things. You know, some of those jobs are actually kind of cool and fun jobs, and some of those services are even tradable, right? So mm-hmm. It's not always the case that just more manufacturing is always better. It kind of depends on what you're comparing it with.
But, I mean, the manufacturing work was associated with a certain kind of high wages and labor unions and things like that. So I mean, I think one thing that you might say about this is sort of in theory, trade has not that much to do with the story of middle class decline or what have you in the United States. But in practice, it does, because what we did was we decimated unionized middle class manufacturing jobs and sort of created in exchange a lot of like Walmart and Uber driving.
Right. I mean, I agree that trade has contributed to that for sure. And that's something that I acknowledge in the book. But there's a lot of other things that we could blame for the decline of highly unionized, high-wage, middle-class jobs. Mm-hmm. And so some that I point to are technological change, which is, of course, related to trade, because maybe you pursue automation in part to compete in the world
right.
economy. So that's, you know, that's related, but it's something that would occur even if we put sky-high tariffs on everything, we would probably still be doing that, right? So that's one thing. But market power is another issue that I think is underappreciated, the extent to which large companies and firms with more market share have sort of suppressed wages in markets where they are dominant. And so that, I think, is something that we've really seen on the rise over this last generation that's contributed to the squeezing of labor and the sort of outsourcing, even domestic outsourcing of some types of jobs in a company. So if you, if you're at a big company that pays high wages, it may pay high wages to its workers, but it might also outsource HR or janitorial services or the food services, you know. And so we get these labor markets that are intensely competitive that aren't benefiting from the gains of these big fancy firms, right? So, so market power and technological change and policy changes too, changes in our labor laws and changes in our tax laws have sort of turbocharge some of these other issues too. And so I think when we look at the whole melange of causes, I think the problem with sort of just singling out trade is that if we just respond in that one area, we're going to be ignoring, you know, maybe 5/6 of the problem while impoverishing other countries and making our the shopping trips of poor people much more expensive. Because if you look at tariffs, they're a regressive tax. The poor spend about 3 times as much of their income on tariffs than the rich do in the United States. So that's
is that just because sort of consumption taxes in general have that regressive structure, or is there something special about the traded commodities?
There's three reasons. One is consumption taxes in general are regressive because poor people don't save and rich people do. But there's two other reasons. Poor people tend to consume a higher share of imports than rich people because they're just consuming more traded goods. And so you might imagine, for instance, going to the grocery store and the types of products that you buy at Walmart might look different from the types that you buy at your local's farmer's market, and you're sort of imagining which consumers get sorted into which store, right? There's going to be more imports in the low-income stores typically. And the third reason, actually, it turns out that the pattern of our trade protection puts higher tariffs on products that poor people consume disproportionately. So if you look at shoes, for instance, like plastic and cheap shoes actually have higher tariff rates than fine leather shoes. Cotton t-shirts have higher tariff rates than cashmere sweaters, right? So so because of the pattern of our protection, in addition to those other two factors, it's a really highly regressive consumption tax. So it's kind of an ironic response to the concerns of the poor to be like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make the things that you buy more expensive.
So I was in Brussels years ago for the sort of launch of TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that wound up not happening. But it was fascinating to me that what they were talking about in talking about having those talks was like almost like it wasn't at all tariffs, really, right? It was all about regulations. And the idea that – and it makes sense when you start to think about it, but products are regulated like most things. And if the regulations are different in different places, then that is a barrier to trade. And so the cars that are – even though we have European cars in the US, they're not the same because the regulations are different. So you actually can't import a car that a French person would drive and vice versa. But that gets the trade talks really, I think, like way outside the economics textbook discussion of trade into an area, I mean, a lot of areas where people start to have suspicions about what's going on.
Yes.
And like, is this just a stalking horse to deregulate everything? Because you can say, well, every regulation is a kind of a trade barrier. So if we're dismantling trade barriers, we've got to, you know, we like get 9 corporate lobbyists together in a room and they say, aha.
Yeah. So I think people have legitimately worried about some of the content of trade agreements in the past. And two examples that come to mind are this investor state dispute settlement procedures where, for instance, companies are authorized to sue states about regulations that they feel have been unfair, effectively. And another area is intellectual property protection, where the U.S. has sort of foisted the intellectual property protection for our fancy companies onto poor countries that may not be able to afford to have such long patents on their drugs or to, you know, or things like that. So those are examples where corporate interests have sort of overtaken trade agreement negotiations to try to push the agenda that's right for them. But while that's certainly a concern. And while I wouldn't include those chapters in my dream trade negotiations of the future, there are also ways in which trade agreements can raise standards. Mm-hmm. Canada and the EU recently signed a trade agreement, and they agreed in very explicit terms that they were going to make sure to keep all of their environmental regulations, you know, and that they were completely authorized to have as many as they wanted, mm-hmm. as long as they applied them in uniform fashion to both Canadians and the EU. So you couldn't, for instance, if you're the EU, you couldn't have like a special one for Canada that was more harsh than the one that you had for your own firms. And those types of more modern trade agreements, and TPP had some of these provisions too that protected environmental regulation and that harmonized labor standards more upward than downward. So Vietnam, for instance, under the CPTPP, which is the acronym that was left after the U.S. left the TPP and mm-hmm. the remaining 11 countries joined together, Vietnam and others agreed to have higher labor rights than they had prior, right, in part as a condition to joining the agreement. So it doesn't have to be a race to the bottom. There, mm-hmm. you know, the very fact that it's called a trade agreement doesn't mean that you have to prejudice corporate interests. And there's been sort of a movement, I think, throughout history to including, I think, more of the things that the left would hold as desirable in these agreements as well.
You talk about this in a climate change context, right, where it's actually sort of important because if you look at like a small country, its carbon dioxide emissions are not globally significant. And yet, if every small country doesn't restrain emissions, you're not going to get anywhere. So you need some mechanism. I mean, obviously, the U.S. is at the moment not doing anything.
Oh, right. But I mean, the U.S. is the same argument, right? It's because we're like, you know, like even if we did everything we could and the other countries don't, right, it's this massive free rider problem. You kind of hope that the other people do it. But if you do it yourself, it's not necessarily in your interest, right? So there's this big argument for international cooperation. Right. And actually, I think the argument for trade agreements and for climate agreements is really similar to the argument for government. Like if you just mm-hmm. let people do their own thing without rules, right? You're not going to have as good an outcome as if you can solve some of these problems of collective action that the government is there to solve. And so you can view international agreements as also solving those mm-hmm. collective action problems because maybe no individual or no company wants to reduce their carbon emissions by themselves.
Right.
And maybe no country even wants to tackle it if the other ones aren't. But if you can agree with others, you know, and it sounds kind of utopian today to even use those sentences, but you know, then you stand a chance of solving these
problems.
But I mean,
because what we were doing, what the U.S. was doing, was going around to a number of Southeast Asian countries and saying, basically, we'll let you in on the textile export game if you adopt our pharmaceutical patent rules.
Yeah.
And we could have said, we'll let you in on the textile export game if you adopt environmental rules.
Absolutely.
Right. So, I mean, that really is just a question. I mean, that's not a question of like, is it good to have trade agreements, but of like, what they look like.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, for instance, there'd be room for a US-EU agreement on solving some of these tax competition problems, right? Because mm-hmm. both the European Union and the United States are wrestling with the fact that multinational companies are really good at avoiding taxes, right? So if you can get governments to band together and be like, okay, we may not agree on the tax rate, and we probably shouldn't agree on the tax rate, but we can agree on provisions that would prevent companies from creating income that's taxed nowhere, right? I mean, so let's get together and agree on that, you know, and that's the kind of thing which also could, I think, be folded into a trade agreement because you've got the sort of carrot there of market access to bring the business community in, and you know, and so you can throw in some other vegetables too.
So let's talk about taxes because this winds up being a surprising amount of your book, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so I mean, the Trump administration's view has been that they have this quote unquote populist take on trade mm-hmm. and then giant corporate tax cut.
Yeah.
Which is maybe not so populist.
Yeah.
But this is a big part of globalization, right? Is profit shifting. And, you know, I was in Ireland on vacation, and there's these lovely little European headquarters of the big American technology companies, which is fine. Dublin's a nice city. You know, you got to have your office somewhere. But a really suspicious amount of profits seem to be accruing to those Dublin offices.
Just to start with the beginning of your question, it always struck me as sort of odd that anyone could call Trump a populist. And I mean, I even do in my book because he tries to sell himself that way. But if you look at the actual contents of the policies, like we're kind of going back to the last Gilded Age in terms of putting more of the costs of raising the government on tariffs, which are, as we pointed out, are regressive, and then massively cutting taxes for those at the top of the distribution. So it's really just not a very...
Right.
It's really hard to characterize something that worsens income inequality with both hands as populist. But turning to the profit shifting issue, I mean, I do think there are both sort of regressive and progressive ways to respond to the challenges of globalization. So I think what we've seen so far is the regressive response, mm-hmm. which is make things more expensive for poor people. But there are progressive responses too. And one response is to say, okay, we recognize that capital is mobile, and we recognize that some laborers are mobile, and we recognize that goods and services are mobile. So how do we modernize our tax system to account for that, right? Mm-hmm. And right now we have a tax system that's incredibly leaky, and a lot of work that I've done suggests that we lose over $100 billion a year due to profit shifting of companies. That's a lot of money that we could be spending on other things. And there's some well-known solutions to that profit shifting that we could pursue. And one of the disappointing things about that tax bill that they passed at the end of 2017 that just went into effect last year is that if you look at the international provisions of that legislation, despite having this huge profit-shifting problem, they're not raising any money by tackling that problem. They sort of make the problem worse with one hand and better with the other.
Uh-huh.
And then they end up getting no extra revenue from the international provisions, which is really surprising given how much we were losing to having companies book their money in Bermuda or the Caymans or places like
so
that.
So how does that work, right?
Yeah.
How do I get to have all my profits be tax-free in the Cayman Islands?
Yeah, so there are several ways you can do it. One is by sort of transferring your intellectual property to the island jurisdiction, right? Effectively, maybe you have a cost-sharing agreement with your Bermuda affiliate where they, you know, share in the costs of creating your intellectual property at some early stage, but then they end up owning it.
Okay.
Right. So, for instance, you could have them own, if you're Starbucks, you could have them own the Starbucks experience. Right.
Okay.
And then when, because they own that, right, you sort of arrange your financial matters such that every affiliate kind of pays them for the privilege of creating the Starbucks experience, right? And then the profit ends up accruing there rather than here, mm-hmm. right? And that's a sort of a simplified version of what's happening. But effectively, you're doing things with your affiliates in other countries to make them look artificially profitable and you look artificially unprofitable. You know, and U.S. multinationals have been very good at this for actually quite a long time. General Electric, for instance, had about a decade where they were making billions and billions of dollars on the planet, but they were getting a refund most years from the U.S. government because they arranged to have so little of it taxed here.
So what do you do about this?
Yeah, so there's a couple different solutions you can pursue. If you want to be more revolutionary, for instance, you could tax foreign income the way we tax national income in the United States, which doesn't actually sound that revolutionary when you put it that way. But in Oregon or California or Virginia, right, we don't ask companies to tell us how much they really earned in Oregon or California or Virginia. We ask, well, how much did you earn in the United States? They tell us a number, and then we apportion that to Oregon or California or Virginia with a formula, right?
Okay.
And so you could do that internationally, too. You could say to Intel or Apple, you could say, well, how much did you earn on the planet? And then you assign some fraction of that global income to the United States based on things like where are your customers, where are your employees, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a system that has worked really well at the subnational level and could, with some time to study, work well internationally. But it's not kind of a day one type proposal that you could do the second, you know, you got control of Congress or something. So in terms of quick things that you could do, you could strengthen the minimum tax. There's sort of the beginnings of a minimum tax in this new tax bill, and you could mm-hmm. make it tougher, such that no matter where you earned the income, you immediately pay tax in the United States. And there's something in there now, but because it has a rate that's half the U.S. rate, so we're sort of saying you're discounted to half the U.S. rate. Two, we're sort of exempting that first 10% return on assets from taxation at all. And three, we're letting companies average their foreign income before they even apply the minimum tax. And so if you change those three features, you could actually make the minimum tax a lot tougher and start to get at a lot of that revenue that way.
So I think sometimes, you know, people can look at this and it can be like baffling.
Yes.
How come Republicans are so lax about this?
Yeah.
And, you know, are they all on the take? Like, what's going on? And the reason, it seems to me, in my experience, is if you talk to, you know, well-credentialed, knowledgeable conservative people, they will say that taxing corporate income is just actually really bad and harmful. So while they agree that the current system is not like great, they're not super interested in clamping down on corporate tax avoidance because they think the whole concept is ill-considered.
Yes, and I disagree very strongly with that for a couple of reasons. One, if you think about corporate tax, it's really our only shot at taxing most U.S. equity income because, as it turns out, 70% of all U.S. capital income doesn't get taxed at the individual level by the U.S. government.
So that's like capital gains and dividends.
Yeah, that's like capital gains and dividends. So, for instance, you might say, well, why not? You know, but if you stop and think about it, your retirement accounts are tax-free because they're in these tax-privileged IRAs and things like that. Mm-hmm. 529 accounts for college savings are tax-free. Endowments and nonprofits have a bunch of capital income that doesn't get taxed at the individual level. Foreigners are investing in the U.S. stock market, and their individual taxes aren't paid to the U.S. government. You know, so if you add all that up, that's about 70% of all the capital income that's in U.S. corporate form, right? And so if you don't tax it at the corporate level, there's only a small sliver of it that's taxed at the individual level. And at the individual level, we're giving huge preferences, you know, the capital gains and dividends rates are much lower than labor rates. You're allowed a step up in basis at death so that if you have a lot of stock and you die, you get to sort of wipe out the capital gain without passing it on to your heirs. You know, so we're actually a very light capital taxation, you know, and so if you ask the same conservative economists, like, is that okay? Some of them would be like, yeah, capital, we shouldn't tax it.
Right.
You know, but I don't think there's either theory or evidence behind that supposition. So one, the theory that they're basing these arguments on, the very people who wrote those papers have changed their mind when they wrote more complicated papers with more realistic assumptions, right? So there's plenty of theoretical work that I think belies this idea that we shouldn't tax capital. But also just look at the data. Like, look at all the countries that have cut capital taxes and ask, did that redound to the glory of their workers? And the answer is no. Like, I mean, country after country, we see these big corporate tax cuts. And then if you look at what happened to the wages of their workers, it's really clear who benefits from that is shareholders. So I think a lot of the interest in eviscerating the corporate tax is coming from people who don't want capital to be taxed at all and who are perfectly comfortable to.
And so this is the deep sort of linkage in what you were saying about globalization, right? Which is that there is a perception that policy changes have been made that have helped enrich capital owners at the expense of workers. And an important question is like, which policy change was that?
Right.
Right. And the move to not tax capital owners on their profits.
That's it.
Has had that impact, like in a very clear and direct way.
Yeah, I mean, taxes are such a powerful policy tool. And if you look at the kind of things that we've subjected workers to over the last generation, all those forces we were just talking about, market power, technology, trade, and you're asking, well, what's the optimal tax policy response to that? It's clear that we should be making the system more progressive, right? We should be handing more money to the workers and taking more from the winners of all of those games, right? From the monopoly power people and the people who own the robots and the shareholders of companies that export. But instead, it seems like our response, and you can look at Congressional Budget Office data on this, the tax system is actually less redistributive now than it was at the beginning of that period.
Right.
Right. So we've moved in the opposite direction, and this latest tax bill is just the latest big step in the opposite direction. I mean, there have been some helpful things along the way, too. But on net, if you look at what the tax system's doing, it's less progressive than it used to be.
But a lot of people have the perception that there's a linkage between these changes, either a sort of left critique that globalization has made it impossible to regulate and govern national economies, or from the business community, like, well, it's a globalized world. We need to be competitive, right? Like, is there something to that? That, like, well, capital is mobile, goods are mobile. You know, Burger King can become Tim Hortons if it wants to, and like, we need to now, we need to either re-erect economic sovereignty, or we need to surrender to these global capital forces.
Yeah, and so to all those people, I say, please read my book because I have lots of ideas in there about how we can really respond to these concerns. But in particular, I think what's really lacking isn't the policy solutions, right? We've got good ways to tax capital in a global economy, and I've got a list of them in the book, right? And we've got good ways to help workers to expand the earned income tax credit, to give free community college, to have wage insurance. We've got all these great ideas. What we're missing is not the feasibility of doing it in a global economy. We're missing political will, right? So we need to, A, win elections by people who care about these issues, but B, have the political will to stand up to the interests that are against it and actually implement these well-known, efficient policies that can both help workers and that can tax those who've really benefited, and to make this a more of a, not just a non-zero-sum game for the world, but a non-zero-sum game for the Americans.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Immigration.
Yes.
Right. I feel like it's become more and more clear that in a lot of ways, immigration is at the emotional heart of political backlash in many countries. And, you know, this is an issue that has some economic dimensions, but also a lot of not economic dimensions.
Yes.
But you're an economist.
Yes.
So what's the economics?
So the economics, I think, is just unbelievably clear that immigrants are net boon to the U.S. economy. It's just there was a National Academies of Sciences review that took all sorts of researchers from across the political spectrum and had them sort of synthesize all of the literature. And it's quite clear that immigrants are good for economic growth. They're good for almost all workers in the economy. The immigration is good for themselves. It's good for innovation. It's good for, you know, you could kind of list all of the benefits, and they're quite large. And it's also helpful, by the way, for our demographic pressures of having like a aging population. But I think there's still some concerns, some economic concerns about immigrants. There's concerns that they might hurt workers in some sectors, right? Because you might think, well, since there's a larger supply of labor, right, they're going to take some jobs. Now, I mean, of course, we need to remember that they also create jobs, that, you know, like half of our billion-dollar startups were founded by immigrants, that 40% of Fortune 500 companies were founded by an immigrant or an immigrant's child. You know, so they're creating jobs as well as filling jobs, and that's an important thing to remember. But there's some concern about that. And there's a little bit of evidence, not a lot, but a little bit of evidence that maybe for teen workers and for recent waves of immigrants, that some of those workers could be hurt.
I think this recent waves of immigrants point is always an interesting one, right? Because, I mean, it's revealing politically, right, that the clearest evidence for some category of workers being hurt by a person from Nicaragua coming tomorrow is that it's the people who came from Nicaragua yesterday who lose out because they're very similar.
Right. And to me, this is less of a concern because if you look at the economic benefits to migrants from moving to the United States, they're very large. Like on average, you get like four times the wage you would get in your home country, maybe five, maybe 10 in some cases, by moving to the United States. So if that means that in your next decade or so, your wage growth is lower because we're letting in more people like you, you know, it's not necessarily that you're going to be worse off than if you'd stayed home, right? You know, so I mean, I think there's just a really compelling, strong case for, you know, more rather than less immigration. I think we're this argument gets harder is if you review all this economic evidence. I mean, a lot of people are like, well, I agree with Chapter 8. Immigration seems to be good. But why is it that people dislike it?
Right.
You know, and then there's a couple things to point out. One is that if you actually look at polling data, people don't. Like, I mean, most people are fine with immigrants. And in the states where they're most fine with immigrants are the states where the immigrants are. Like, the places where people are highly suspicious about immigrants are often states with very few immigrants. Another thing to point out is even some of these cultural fears are sort of misunderstood. You know, if you look at the actual data, it looks like immigrants are assimilating faster than they used to assimilate in past generations. It looks like their crime rates are lower than people who were born in the United States. You know, it looks like on net they're strengthening rather than weakening the institutions of their community. So it's really just hard to make a logical case against
immigration. I did think you had an anecdote in there, though, that sort of got at this, which was you talked about this grocery store, right? And well, just tell me what was the deal?
The grocery store in Belgium?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was making the point in the book that, you know, the United States is a nation of immigrants and it's hard to really sort of pinpoint our American traits aside from noting that they're sort of a hodgepodge of the immigrants that have come to the United States. And so I was in a grocery store in Brussels where I lived for a year when I was, you know, a younger person. And I was shopping at this grocery store that I think catered to EU bureaucrats because they had little flags in different aisles that showed you like, oh, this is Norwegian food and this is Swedish food. And in the distance, I saw Stars and Stripes and I was like, oh, that's exciting. Let's go see what American food was there. And I got over to the Stars and Stripes, and there were like beans and tortillas and salsas, and it was all Mexican food, which was awesome because I missed that from being an American. You know, so it was sort of a reminder that in a way there isn't American cuisine. There's just a hodgepodge of our immigrant cuisines, and that's why our food is better than it would be.
As I said I was just in Ireland, and it's striking that a lot of the foods that, you know, we eat at home are very present there everywhere, you know, hamburgers and pizza and stuff like that. But like what really does come across as I would distinctively American as opposed to Irish, say, is what we would call Mexican food, right? That there's no, there are no black beans in a regular supermarket in Dublin.
Yeah.
But I did see like one supermarket that was bigger had like an American section and they had old El Paso taco kits there. But I feel like that does sort of cut to the heart of it, that there's some people, like I think you and I and probably most Weeds listeners are of the social class in America that finds this incredibly charming, the discovery that like the real American food is Tex-Mex.
Yes.
But then there is a sense in which, okay, no, like that is changing American culture, right? Like in 1950, nobody would have said that like real American food was tacos.
Yeah, but they might have said real American food is pizza or other things that we borrowed from prior generations of immigrants, you know, which themselves were vilified earlier. You know, like, I mean, Italian immigrants used to be vilified. Irish immigrants used to be vilified. If you go back far enough, you can find people vilifying any group. So I guess one lesson from the American experience is that hopefully we can overcome, you know, these waves of vilification and realize that on that, you know, these groups make us stronger. And I think there's just overwhelming evidence for that.
And it just seemed to me like a difference between the U.S. and European immigration context is that we do have that trajectory, right? You can point in America to a time at which pizza and spaghetti were like incredibly exotic, and now they're very, very normalized, and say that, you know, like in a patriotic way with a flag and stuff, that like this is what America is all about. In a way that, like, I'm not sure that is what Denmark is all about.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting contrasts here is actually if you look at European immigration patterns, like a lot of European countries now have a higher share of foreign-born population in the United States, which is surprising.
Sure.
But what they don't have is hundreds of years of history where that was true, right? So for them, it's been a much more rapid increase over a shorter period of time, in part because of the Syrian conflict and in part because of other economic factors. But for us, it is this really long historical trajectory. It is.
Although even so, when you get to policy recommendations, your ideas they're not that different from the Trump administration's, right?
I would not say that. Yeah.
Well, to say that, well, there should be maybe more focus on skills and education.
I say there should be more skilled immigration at the same time that we're also increasing. So if you look, I suggest an increase in the unskilled as well as an increase in the skilled and a path to citizenship for the undocumented that's compassionate. So I think in all in all of those areas, I'm way more pro-immigrant than anyone you could find in the Trump administration, because I kind of want more of every type of immigrant.
So their view is we should cut legal immigration in half, but make it more skill biased and, I guess, kick everybody out.
Yeah.
And you're saying, no, we should have a path to citizenship. We should maybe shift to more refugees and fewer, like, siblings, and also increase skilled immigrants. But I always think it's interesting where the empirical evidence has more of a consensus than the politics.
Yeah, so the empirical evidence is so crystal clear about high-skilled immigrants that I think even the Trump administration could find reasons to like them. Although I would point out that they're also discouraging them at the same time, because they're slowing down the processing of certain types of visas and they're lowering certain types of quotas that would have attracted.
Right.
You know, so I think we can exaggerate their professed enthusiasm here. But the empirical consensus is really strong that the high-skilled are just a boon. I think the arguments that I'm making for increasing the low-skilled ones are partly demographic, and then I think it helps to have workers of every type, and it helps to have a less aging population, and partly moral. I think, you know, there's a reason that many of us learned that poem at the base of the Statue of Liberty when we were children, and I think setting that aside makes us a worse country. So I'd rather have us have an ethical obligation to the world's poor, which doesn't mean completely open borders, but it means, you know, having an open heart when people nearby need a place.
Right. And I mean, it's worth reiterating that the benefits of immigration to the immigrants are very
enormous.
Large. It's
yes.
Something like, what is it? It's like a fivefold
increase on average. And it's a huge efficiency gains from the world perspective. And these people go on to be Americans, right? I mean, very patriotic and loyal Americans. You know, I also tell this story about I don't know if you ever have sriracha sauce on your food.
Sure.
But that company was founded by a refugee who came here. We were the only country that would take him at the time. And he named the company after the boat that he came on. You know, and so whenever you have that sriracha sauce, you should be thinking about good reasons to be kind to refugees, because he's kept all that production in the United States in part because he views it as the patriotic thing to do.
Well, this was the trap I was going to spring on you at the end, though. So you tell this story, right, of the guy, the Hui Fang sriracha sauce guy, refugee. He loves America. So he keeps his factory in the United States as a great patriot.
Mm-hmm.
But then back when we were talking about trade, right?
No, I don't think you should have to, by the way.
But when you tell that story, right? So it's very clear what the point of that story is, right? That he loves America, so he keeps his factory here.
Yeah, yeah.
But doesn't that mean that it would be more patriotic for other companies to give us some of that same consideration that Vietnamese refugees do?
I think I appreciate the skillfulness with which you made that point. And I certainly would be in favor of changing the tax code, for instance, so that we weren't actually encouraging with our tax system companies to offshore, which we do presently. We're giving companies half the tax rate if they're offshore relative to the United States. So there's all sorts of things we could do to make production in the United States more attractive and to make working in the United States nicer for the workers, too. But I would be, I guess, a little loath to make it all of these decisions moral, even though I like telling that story about the sriracha sauce because I think it's very sweet and it reminds us that, you know, like refugees do become these like very attached Americans, right, which is great. But I don't think every company should have to have every part of their production process in the United States. I mean, I think by splitting up these tasks and moving them across borders, we actually make for more efficient processes and we make for more interconnected economies. And that can be a really nice thing. Like one of the big achievements of the European Union was to make Europe so interconnected that things like World War I and World War II were less attractive to start because you needed each other, right? And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, so I think that's an important part of the book, right, is to try to make a case for a worldview, right, and not just a specific kind of thing about this tariff or that, right? But the idea that it's better to be more interdependent, yes, rather than less.
Yes. Yeah, and I firmly hold that to be true, not just because of the gains from specialization, which are true, because, I mean, you could sort of imagine yourself, for instance, if you tried to do everything yourself, there's not a quicker path to poverty than I can imagine than me trying to make my own food, for instance.
Like, right.
I would end up starving to death. But so I think, you know, there's all sorts of efficiency gains from it. But I also think it's just, you know, the human experiment is a joint one, you know, and I think that being dependent on other countries and having interactions with other countries and having global relationships makes it a lot easier when we have problems like climate change or terrorism or global health problems to solve if we've got partners and we've got a shared human experience and we're not all kind of separated into our own little fiefdoms that are sort of snarling at each other.
Right. That's great. I'm going to let you go soon, but just close out. Like, is there what should I have asked you? What did we miss here?
Oh, what did we
What's
miss?
What's really
here?
Important?
I guess the question I would ask sort of is what, you know, where we should go from here and what is the best response to having suffered through the first few years of the Trump administration.
Yeah, where do we go from here? How do we rebuild?
Yeah, and I think that what I always would suggest when you've got a problem is to try to take the policies that go most directly to that problem. So we do have a real problem with middle class wage stagnation and income inequality, and we've got just a host of policy tools that I talk about late in the book that are really effective at responding to those. And so whenever we have a problem, be it climate change or economic stagnation, I think taking the tools that go directly to the problem instead of blaming a foreigner and hoping that somehow trickles down to help the problem, I think that's what I would really encourage people to do, is to sort of think, is this the most direct tool to that problem?
Right. Yeah. So if you want higher wages, more do the programs that do that.
Yeah. Earned income tax credit expansion is a really effective way to move money to workers who aren't making enough. You know, it's proven. We've got it already. We can make it more generous. And that would be really helpful. Whereas these corporate tax cuts to shareholders is a very indirect mechanism of helping workers. And so is a tariff, right? I mean, we're counting on, you know, a handful of steel workers to raise the middle class. And that's, you know, while we're simultaneously hurting auto workers and soybean farmers, you know, that is not an effective, straightforward way to help workers.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, Professor Kimberly Clausing from Reed College. Thank you to Jeff Geld, our producer, and of course to Bird Pinkerton and the Weeds. We'll be back on Tuesday.